Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Chasing Justice. I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and I'm happy to be here with you again. I had an interesting time this past weekend. I had an opportunity to sit and have a conversation with my 92-year-old uncle. Really a great guy. He has all his faculties at 92 years old. I'll tell you what, I'd sign that contract right now if somebody would give it to me to get 92 years out of a wonderful life. But I was at a wedding celebration, so there was a lot of conversation about life and love and all those kind of great things that we all like to be a part of. So we started talking, and I started to ask, you know, where are you from, and how did you meet, you know, my aunt, and so many years ago, and get to the point where you are. And he was telling me about his younger life, and he was trying to find work. You know, I've got 92. It's almost 100 years ago. So he tells me he ended up in the Navy during World War II, which was an interesting conversation because I knew he'd been in the military. I just didn't know the full story of where he had been over the course of time. And he actually served in a PT boat squadron in Leyte Gulf in the Philippines in 1944 as the war was raging on, World War II. And it was interesting to hear from him of what the world was like then. And he put it very succinctly. He said it was cleaner. You know, there were still problems. Everybody still had the same problems that they have today. But the world was cleaner then. You know, people treated each other better, in his opinion, of how they were. So this conversation went round and round. A couple other fellows ended up joining us, and we're sitting there talking about, you know, life in general. It's interesting to talk to someone who's 92 years old and get their perspective on things and see what they think about, you know, way back then compared to now. And the topic of football season came up. Now, I know this has been covered a million times by a million different people with the NFL and the kneeling, you know, everybody kneeling during the playing of the national anthem. But I wanted to get his opinion on it. And I asked him, I said, hey, Uncle John, I know you like football, and I think he's a Philadelphia Phillies fan. I mean, Philadelphia Eagles fan, sorry about that. He's down in that area of Pennsylvania. And he just had this look of disgust on his face, and he kind of just shook his head, and he says, you know, we have to be worried about everybody. But to kneel during the national anthem is just so disrespectful. And I said, well, what's disrespectful about it? I mean, the players in the NFL seem to have a grievance, and they're trying to make their point of view known, and they're doing that by kneeling to draw attention to it. And he says, Joey, I'll tell you what. People can have a grievance, and they do have a grievance, and it's something we should pay attention to. But to do it during the national anthem is completely disrespectful to everybody who served in the military. He goes, I was out there in the war with young men who died. They were killed in the middle of that war, fighting for everybody's rights back home. Everybody's rights back home. And then to see these football players take a knee during the national anthem and raise their fist in protest is just very, very painful for me to see. And I said, you know, that's kind of the feeling that I had about it. But to hear it from someone who actually served there. Now, we've heard from Bill Dallas a few times. And Bill also served in the military. And Bill says it's difficult for him to see it, even though he understands there may be grievances that we as a country should address. But the reality is, when there's protesting like that, at the time of the national anthem, that hurts all of us. So I had to give this some thought. You know, my initial reaction to the whole kneeling thing was that I just don't like that kind of disrespect to our country. I have never seen our country, me personally, I've never broken our country down into black and white, Hispanic, Asian. I just saw us all as Americans. You know, as long as we're all in the same boat together and we're rowing in the same direction, we're all Americans, and I just never saw that kind of a split to see, you know, the communities seem on two different sides of this issue. One of the young fellows I was talking to at the wedding was an African-American young man, and him and I were having this conversation where we were kind of dancing around what Uncle John had said. And Uncle John had left the conversation at this point. And I said to the young fella, I said, "So, you know, where do you stand on this whole thing? I mean, this whole kneeling." And he said, "Well, you know, I kind of understand it, and I see why they're doing it, and they have a right to do it." And I said, of course they have a right to do it. No one denies they have a right to do it. I said, "But how do you feel about them kneeling during the national anthem? These players in the NFL that are making millions of dollars and, you know, they're role models for all people in our country. It's not limited to specific sections of our country. Everybody looks up to these players as heroes, and you know what they can do. Their skill levels are amazing." And he goes, yeah, but you know, at the same time, you know, there's a lot of things that go on in the country that are just not right, and if this draws attention to it, then I'm okay with it." And I said, "Okay, well, I try to see that perspective. I honestly do. You know, the title of this program, Chasing Justice, is not just a catchy little saying that I came up with. It's actually what I'm trying to do is justice. You know, we talk about justice. Justice is in everything. It runs through every part of life. And if we look to our religious values, we always see that justice is a huge component of any religious set of rules or religious tenets. Justice is important. You have to have justice or you can't have anything else. So I'm listening to my Uncle John, I'm listening to this young fella at the wedding, and I'm trying to compare my own thoughts about this. And I think it came right back down to what I said a few minutes ago, is that I never saw this schism in our country. I've looked at people and said, "Well, I'm American, but you're almost American," or "I'm American, you're not American," or "You're this kind of American." I just, we're all Americans, and that red, white, and blue is who we are. You know, it doesn't matter your skin color, it doesn't matter your background, it doesn't matter your nationality. You know, none of that matters. What matters is that you're American, and you're red, white, and blue, all of us. So I guess the point that really I'm trying to make is that I don't necessarily see it from the point of view of the players. Then again, I am not one of the players. I didn't have their life experience. So I'm open to understanding that there could be things that go on that I don't see. I did spend almost 30 years in law enforcement, and I know that the point of view about law enforcement is skewed, you know, and I think that might be some of the problem, is that what we see on the news media when we see a police officer take some type of action against someone, trying to arrest someone who's resisting. It's an ugly thing when somebody resists and you have to use force. When one human being has to use force against another human being, that's an ugly thing. You know, it's just unfortunately when a white police officer has to arrest a minority individual and there's resistance, you know, that becomes supposed to be, this is how cops are all the time. They're just picking on this individual because they're a minority, or they're attacking this person because they're a minority. And I found that not to be true in the course of my career as a law enforcement officer. And believe me, I looked because I wanted to make sure, you know, is any of this true? Because I didn't feel that way. I didn't treat people any differently because of their race or their religion or anything. If you were doing something wrong, I locked you up. If you deserved a break, I gave you a break. I used the discretion built into the system that law enforcement officers have. I helped anybody that I could help. Didn't matter to me who they were or where they were from. And when I saw the cops around me, I didn't see that kind of behavior either. Now, I'm not going to say that I didn't hear people say stupid things in the heat of the moment. Of course they do. But you know what? I heard those things on both sides. I heard the cops called names. I heard the cops attacked. And then I saw the cops respond. And sometimes they said ugly, stupid things, just like the bad guys and the bad girls said ugly, stupid things. Is that an excuse for it? No, it's not. You know, I think what we have to do is we have to respect each other. And if you know that there's a word that hurts somebody's feelings, you don't use it. But words, like I've always said here, words mean things, and words are very often used as weapons. So when people are in a conflict, and people are going to be swinging punches at each other, throwing words around that you know are going to hurt each other, or something that happens also. So that aside, we know all of us, no matter who we are, sometimes we say stupid, dumb, hurtful, ugly things. But I didn't see any meetings in the beginning of the morning where we all got together and said, okay, let's go pick on the Italian guys today. Let's go pick on the Irish guys today. Let's go pick on the African American guys today. That never, ever happened. We went out and did our business, and whoever came up on the radar because of committing crime or doing something else, that's who we focused on, not because of who they were or their race or their color, their skin or anything like that. So I knew that that didn't happen to the degree that a lot of people think it does. And I know when we see these ugly things on TV that look bad, a cop trying to arrest somebody, throwing them to the ground, slamming them down, handcuffing them, fist fighting, that's all ugly. But we have to remember at all times, the police are there to represent us. They're not a rogue band of guys that just got uniforms and guns and went out and decided to, you know, do whatever they're doing. We, the people, have decided that we want to live under a set of laws. We don't want chaos. We want to live a life that is more regimented, more where we all follow agreed set of rules, and people that don't have to be held to account. And when you try to arrest somebody and they don't want to be arrested and they resist, the police officer's not supposed to just walk away. Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't realize you didn't want to be arrested today. Well, here's a card that gives the address of the police department. And why don't you turn yourself in at your convenience if you feel like it? You know, no big deal. That's absurd. That is not how our system works. So what happens is someone resists, and then the officers use force to enforce the law. See a connection there, a little connect the dots thing? So what happens, though, if you pull away when a police officer is trying to arrest you, the officer is allowed to grab you. If you swing, an officer is allowed to use greater force than you to overcome your force. It's not a fair fight. It's not meant to be a fair fight. We, the people, have put the police out there. And we, the people, have said, we want you to do what we've asked, and that is enforce the law. We've given our officers the power to enforce the law, and they're not out there to get hurt. Cops are not out there that if somebody wants to swing at them, shoot at them, use a stick or a knife, they have to take it first before they're allowed to respond. That's not how it works. Unfortunately, the reality is there are some situations that happen where an officer anticipates it looks like this is going to go bad, and they take action that looks horrible on camera. Now, of course, I'm going to throw the caveat in. Yes, there are times that officers have reacted with too much force that was not appropriate. Sometimes they did it with malice, and those people should be arrested. All right? The privilege of being a law enforcement officer and the powers that come with it should never, ever be abused. And it really bothers me that I have to say this every time we have this conversation so I'm not misunderstood. But I want to be clear about it. Cops should do the right thing. They are held to account. They are within the law, right? They're not above the law. Police officers are not above the law. They have to follow the rules. But the rules that are set up is that if the police tell you you're under arrest, the only option you have is to submit, not to argue, not to pull away, not to disagree, not to run away, not to fight. Your only option is to submit to the arrest. If you disagree with what the officer's doing, you bring that up in court. Right? That's where you bring those things up. So I'm going to tell you, I've seen thousands of arrests, participated in them, and there was never a time that somebody was told you're under arrest and they submitted that there was any further problem. The problem always comes when the person refuses to submit. So that's a long way around, a little circuitous route around here to say that I understand that because there's perceptions in many communities that the cops are just out to get people or they hate people for all kinds of reasons, and that's why we see these things. The reality is the media does not show you the other incidences of cops doing the same thing with people who are not minorities. They don't show those videos. unless there's something horrific that they can point out about the police. They don't always show you the violence that people cause against the police. They edit the video a little bit. They tell the story in a little bit of a different way to give you the impression that the cops acted improperly or they acted too quickly. And unfortunately, this is what makes the impression for all of us, not just our minority communities, but all our communities think that the police sometimes overreact or often overreact. And this is where I'm trying to understand the football players. I'm trying to understand from their perspective, from their life experience, that is this something they've actually experienced, or is it something that they've heard about and therefore they think it's true? They've seen the video on TV and they don't like what they're seeing. I don't like when I see those things. I don't like to see those videos where cops are arresting someone and it's violent. It's like I said, it's an ugly thing to watch, people in that kind of conflict. But what led up to that? Now, if the cops just decided, hey, we're going to go pick on that guy because he's an Italian guy, that's wrong, and they should be held to account. But if that guy standing up, and the reason I say Italian guy is because I'm Italian, so that's why I can say it in our politically correct world. All right? But if that guy standing on the corner, that Italian guy, is doing something illegal, and the police roll up and say, come here, put your hands on the car, don't move, and that guy decides to not put his hands on the car, decides to walk away, decides to shove the cops, decides to fight with the cops, decides to pull a weapon on the cop, that's not going to go well for that person, no matter who they are. If that person simply complies with the officers, and remember, the officers are there because we put them there, right? We created the police department to enforce the law so we, the citizens, don't have to go do it ourselves. So that's a long way around to say that I'm trying really hard to understand, and it's come to this. We are all Americans. We are all one family. If the football players have a grievance, then we should hear the grievance. We should listen to the grievance. We should be able to have the conversation and really see what we can do to help alleviate the grievance. First, we got to understand, is the grievance real? Is it true to the extent that they feel it's true? And is there anything we can do to make things better? That's what we should do as American family. So while I understand that they're trying to bring attention to this, I think protesting by kneeling during the national anthem hurts people like my Uncle John. It hurts veterans who have served our country. It hurts other people who love those people. And if you have a family where you only worry about one side of the family's feelings and concerns, and you ignore and hurt the other side of the family, it doesn't help the family at all. It causes problems. So we're all one big family. And yes, we have to have concerns for what the players are saying. But the players, at the same time, should be concerned with how their response is making other parts of the family feel. That would be justice. And we'll be back in a minute with round two.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutLoud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network. You know, at the end of that first segment there, I got a little tongue-tied, and I know you heard it, but that's a very emotional thing, this whole kneeling thing. I'm trying to be a good American. I'm trying to be a good brother to all my brothers and sisters in the country, no matter who they are. And that whole topic and thinking about my Uncle John and how him and other people are hurt by the kneeling, as well as the guys who were kneeling because they're hurt by what they see going on or feel that's going on, it's very emotional. And it actually caught up to me. So I got a little tongue-tied at the end. And this is Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network. Now, this is an excellent network. If this is your first time listening to Chasing Justice, I'm glad you're here. But there's other shows on this network that are awesome. You really need to check it out. And it's 24/7, every day of the week. It's there's programming that is there's something for everybody, and it's all free speech. There's no rules here about what we can and can't say. We're simply told to go out and give your opinion and have conversation so that we can have some good radio. So the America Out Loud Network is excellent, and I'm glad you're listening. Tell your friends about it. I had some more sponsors here on Chasing Justice, because nothing gets done without sponsors. We have A-Plus Technology and Security out of Bayshore, New York. They are leaders in any type of safety and security equipment, planning, training, you name it. They're outrageous. You can find them at aplussecurity.com. aplustechnology.com. aplustechnology.com. The Emcon IT Company, leaders in data recovery. emconit.com, emconit.com, and my company, Pangaro Training. We are trying to do the best we can to train law enforcement, school personnel, and the business community how to be safe and how to secure their facilities and do the right thing and help everyone have a safe time at work and at home. So that's jpangaro.com, the letter J, P as in Peter, A-N-G-A-R-O.com. Also, check us out on Chasing Justice on Facebook. Take a look. There's a lot of pictures and a lot of stuff on there I think you might like. You're part of the Chasing Justice family now, so you might as well go take a look at some of that stuff, and we can have a little conversation going on there. All right, so where do I want to go from here with Chasing Justice? Now, you might be saying, where's the neighborhood guys today? You know, don't we usually have a segment to the neighborhood? Well, believe it or not, even the guys in the neighborhood like to go away and do some things once in a while. So I've actually reached out to Bill, and Bill tells me he would like to call in because he's on vacation. And I said, oh, that's all right. Jim will be here with Race Car Jack. And I call Race Car Jack, and Race Car Jack says, I'm in Florida. I'll be back next week. Okay, great. Well, I figured Jim the Contrarian, where's he going to go? Well, guess what? Jim is in Massachusetts this weekend. So what we have is we have me, Lieutenant Joe, and you here on Chasing Justice. So we'll spend a couple minutes here. I had another interesting conversation that I try to relate to justice, because that's really the essence of our program here. And somebody brought up to me and said, we were talking about law enforcement and how police work goes and detective work, and I was asked about DNA. How does DNA, has it changed law enforcement? And I guess the conversation that was part of our program last week about Molly Tibbetts, this young lady from Iowa, she's still missing, and the investigation is dragging on for another week, and still no conclusion to what happened to this young lady. Where is she? And the conversation led to other cold cases and technology that police use and this and that. And DNA came up. DNA is extremely important in the world of law enforcement. We have seen cases made that never would be. It's even better, much better, than fingerprint identification. It is very unique to the person. Well, in the conversation, this person asked me, said, well, how do you feel about cops going to these databases that are not law enforcement databases where DNA is stored? And this would be, the companies that take your DNA can tell you all about your ancestry and your history and all that. And there's been a couple of high-profile cases where law enforcement has gone to those companies with a search warrant and or subpoena, whatever is appropriate in their state, and they have looked at samples to get to help them ID people. And the way that works is that your DNA not only reveals specifically who you are, because your DNA is unique to you, there are also many parts of your DNA that are unique to your family. All right, so other people in your family share some of your DNA, and then there's parts of DNA that's completely unique to you. So what they'll do is they'll get a search warrant, and they'll go to one of these companies with a sample. And they will say, here, would you run this sample of crime scene DNA that we recovered at the scene of this crime? And can you compare that to your database and let us know if you have certain markers that hit? And a hit would be something that would be a connection. So there'd be a connection from the crime scene DNA to DNA that's stored in their database. It may or may not be the criminal. It could be somebody from the criminal's family. And the way that works is, if I went to a homicide and there was DNA, blood or body fluids from the killer left at the scene, on the body or in the scene, whatever, and I took that sample, I would run it through the law enforcement DNA network to see if we could find someone who's been arrested before who's had DNA samples taken. If that doesn't work, I go to these other companies and say I'm in Georgia. That's where the crime takes place, and I'm investigating it there. And then I put it through one of these private companies that keeps DNA and tells people who their families are. And I say, compare this sample of DNA to your database. And they come up and say, well, we have a couple of hits here. Excuse me, sorry about that. I don't have a cough button. They say, we have a couple of hits here. In other words, we have a couple of familial connections to your DNA. And you get that list. And there may be three people who live in New Jersey. There could be two or three people that live in California. And there's two people that live in Georgia that had put their DNA into this system voluntarily. Well, obviously, we look at that DNA from Georgia because that's where the crime took place. And we find out that Bill Jones and Muriel Jones gave their DNA. So we try and find out who are Bill and Muriel Jones. And then we start to look at their family through public access records. We probably go and interview them. Hey, how are you? Did you know our murder victim? No, do you know anyone who knows the murder victim? And we find out, oh, yeah, actually, my son dated that girl about 10 years ago. We were shocked when we heard what happened to her. Well, guess what? That leads us to Harry, the son or the nephew, whoever it was, that dated the murder victim. We go to Harry. We want to interview him. He either cooperates and talks to us, or he gets a lawyer. He lawyers up, or whatever. Maybe we find that he might be a suspect. You know, we do more investigating and find out that, hey, he had been seeing the girl again, whatever the case may be. And then we get a warrant if we have to get a DNA sample from him. And then there's a match. Case closed. You actually have an arrest. But there's concerns with this. That's a lot of power, you know, to give to government. You know, and my concern, even though I came from a public sector background, law enforcement, I am always concerned with the overreach of law enforcement and government, particularly. When we look, we see what has gone on with the case against the president, President Trump, and we see how the Department of Justice and the FBI apparently got together and worked with the Clinton campaign to try and damage candidate Trump and then President Trump. This is an overreach of government power. You see how hard they're fighting to reveal that, because you would probably be annoyed to find out your government did that. Even our friends on the left, I would think, once the truth comes out, I would hope that they wouldn't be so partisan that they couldn't see what a horrible thing that is for all of us. But the long and short of it is that technology is powerful. DNA technology is very powerful, and finding someone through other people's DNA is the next battlefield of this. So that conversation led to my comments that if there's a search warrant involved, if you have a warrant, then I think you should be able to get that information. But you have to have probable cause. You don't just walk in and say, you know, here, give me this. And I don't know. I have honestly not had to apply for one of those kind of warrants. These companies are kind of new. But as long as there's a search warrant that is issued, or whatever official appropriate document that has court oversight that you can get those records, then I think wouldn't we want to solve murders? So this person responded back. I was having a conversation with, said, yeah, but do you think that's fair? They should find other people's DNA and lead you to them. And I said, well, don't we want to find people who've committed crimes, no matter what kind of crime it is? If we can use this technology and find them, shouldn't we? Or should we just not use it because it seems too powerful? And the person said, well, what if we limited the uses we could have for this DNA to very serious crimes like murder, sexual assault, kidnapping, things like that? And then the other stuff, we wouldn't use it. And I said, well, that's an interesting concept. I think Jim the Contrarian might have something to say on that. Is it a fact that we want to enforce every single law, no matter what it takes to do it? Or do we want to set guidelines for when we would use this kind of technology? Is shoplifting something that you would want to use DNA if you had it to catch a shoplifter? Or is that something that we figure is so petty, we don't care that much about it? Homicide, though, I think we'd all agree that if you have someone who's murdered and you can get the DNA and find out who did it, that would be a good thing, I would think. But then again, people have lots of different ideas about these kind of topics. So our DNA topic went from, is it okay to get it? When should you be able to get it? Is it even appropriate to get it? To what about the use of DNA that we see most popularly? And when I say most popularly, I think where everyone can agree, we see the use of DNA that's clearing people who are sitting in prison. It's clearing them from the crimes they've been convicted of, sometimes sitting in jail for decades for crimes that, according to the DNA, they didn't commit. And if we look at the DNA and we say it's enough to convict someone for doing something, that we're positive that they did it because their DNA is there, it should be enough to clear them if the DNA from the crime scene is not theirs. And I agree with that wholeheartedly, unless there's other circumstances. You may not have left DNA at the scene and been convicted. So I'm not saying if there's no DNA, you can't convict. We don't want to set that up because that would be detrimental to justice, and that would be detrimental to the victims if you had to have DNA in every crime in order to convict. So what we look at is, though, how many times have we seen on the news where, for whatever reason, there's a group that takes the case of a prisoner who's been sitting in jail for 5 years, 10 years, or 35 years, and they end up going through the court system to have the evidence screened through a DNA screening. And it turns out that the person who was convicted of whatever the crime was, it's not their DNA, it's someone else's. And they've been saying that they're innocent all along. And now the DNA proves that whatever they were convicted for wasn't them, and they're released. I am fully in favor of that. I am fully in favor that we want justice, don't we? Isn't that what we're really all about? Not just getting a conviction. Could you imagine being a person that was accused of a crime, put in prison, and you sit there for your whole life, or most of your adult life, 20 years, 25 years, and you know you really did not commit that crime, and nobody believes you. And you sit there in prison, you lose your family, you lose your children, you lose your freedom, which we only have, you know, how many years do you get? My Uncle John got 92 so far. Most people get 75 or 80. So how would you like to sit there for 25 years knowing you didn't do it? And there's a way to find out and prove that, but nobody is willing to do it. So here's what I'm suggesting. I think there should be funds set up, federal funds should be set up, that in every case in which someone is sitting in prison and there is DNA in that case, those files should be opened and that DNA should be tested. And if it turns out that the people sitting in prison, it's not their DNA, they should immediately be removed and compensated for their time. This is justice. The guilty should be held accountable and have to pay a penalty for what they do. But if you're innocent and we can prove that the person was innocent, we owe that to every single member of our society. Wouldn't you want that for yourself? Wouldn't you want that for your family members? For friends of yours that were accused of something? I think it's pretty clear that that's the right thing to do. And I would be fully and completely in favor of that. So that's, I don't know what we would call it, the DNA Testing Act of 2018 or 2019, or the Chasing Justice DNA Freedom Act. That has a nice ring to it, if you ask me, where anybody, everybody, every case with DNA, they would go back in time and they would check them against the person who was convicted. Now, I think you're going to find in most of the cases, the overwhelming majority of cases, you will find that the DNA at the crime scene is going to match the individual who's sitting in the jail cell. Because contrary to popular belief, which is, you know, everybody in jail says they didn't do it, the reality is the police and prosecutors normally only arrest and go after people who actually did it. But that doesn't negate the fact that in reality, we know right now, in probably every one of our states, there are people sitting in jail who did not do it. And they were convicted based on eyewitness testimony. They were convicted based on other circumstantial type of evidence. And as we have found out over the course of time, eyewitness accounts can be very bad. They can be excellent, but they can also be very bad. And circumstantial evidence, boy, sometimes you're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. We've all seen that movie, haven't we? Where somebody walks in on a crime scene and they pick up the knife and they want to try and help the person and, uh-oh, now I picked up the knife. I got the blood on me. I I got my fingerprints on the knife. What are we supposed to do now? I'm sure there are cases like that have happened over the years. So the 2019 Chasing Justice DNA Justice Act, I'm going to say we should reach out to our elected representatives and say, let's get this together and let's make sure justice runs strong in our system so that only the guilty are sitting in jail and not someone was improperly convicted, because there's no justice to that. So we all suffer when that happens. So it was an interesting conversation over DNA. It's really an amazing and very powerful technology that we have at our disposal to help us have a more just world by making sure we hold people accountable who should be. So we'll be back in a couple minutes with round three here on Chasing Justice.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Bing, 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 as we say here on Chasing Justice. Welcome to round three. Now, the fellas in the neighborhood, I told you they're on vacation, and that's great. I don't take vacation. I stay here with you, my Chasing Justice audience. I'm looking over the news, and I'm saying there's some strange things going on out there in the world we should probably take a look at. First, let's look at this this woman, Omarosa, or Omarosa. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce the name. I remember when she first popped up on the scene when she was on Donald Trump's TV show, The Apprentice. And she looked like a very capable woman. I'm not sure if she won or not. I didn't watch the show that often, but I know she made a big splash. So I'm assuming that she probably won. And then you started to hear that there were some problems, you know, whether she acted appropriately, not appropriately, I'm not sure. Like I said, I didn't really watch too much, but her name was out there. And it's an interesting name, Omarosa. You know, kind of rolls off the tongue nicely. She's an attractive woman. And like I said, she seemed very, very competent. And then Trump runs for president. He ends up in the White House. And guess what? He brings her along as part of the staff, I guess. She must have been competent, or he must have thought she deserved a break, because this is kind of the impression I've gotten about this president over the years. You know, he did a lot of really nice things for people quietly. It's amazing. Prior to 2016, nobody hated this guy. Nobody thought he was a racist. Nobody thought he was horrible. Nobody wanted to bust up his buildings. Everybody liked Donald Trump. He was an interesting American figure. I remember being younger when all the, you know, during the 80s, when the Reagan era, when people were talking about, you know, the decade of greed, our friends on the left, you know, because the economy was doing so well, based on conservative policies, that they really couldn't abide by that. So they had to come up with something that, you know, excessive greed that people had was bad. It was all because of, you know, Reagan. That's why this excessive greed took place, and the economy was rolling along, and people were making a lot of money. And Donald Trump this is the first time I think I heard something negative, was that he had his books out and he was this millionaire playboy kind of guy. I guess he became a billionaire playboy guy, but you know, he was out there living this lifestyle that suddenly was bad. Now, when you compare that to what goes on in Hollywood, I think he was pretty tame. But anyway, we started to hear, you know, that Trump Tower was the greatest place to live. Everybody thought the guy was awesome as a young person. And they started to put down money and they started to put down people who were successful. I said, are you kidding? I don't dislike Trump. I want to be like Trump. You know, I want to build an empire. I would love to have an empire and a business that generated thousands of jobs for people and billions of dollars in income and give me a good lifestyle. I was never against that kind of thing. I'm an entrepreneurial person. I have my company, jpangaro.com. I've been teaching and training law enforcement, schools, and business people for the last almost 10 years now. Longer than that, if you count what I did when I was a police officer. I was teaching in police academies. But I never had a problem with people getting wealthy and earning money here in America. That's part of what we do. We also do a lot of charity. I know personally I do charity, and that's because of Mrs. Lieutenant Joe. She was always pushing me to do more. We've been blessed. You know, every time I made a little bit more money, she wanted to do a little bit more in charity. And I did so willingly because I did feel I was blessed. I've told all of you before, I really came from very meager beginnings, and I've made my place in the world based on hard work, taking chances, coming up with something new, and trying to fill voids wherever I could that people would be willing to pay for. So I'm not a connected guy. I don't have a connected family. I don't have a a silver spoon or anything like that. I was lucky I had any spoon. And that's not to pat myself on the back. That's to point out an example that anybody can do this. If you want to get ahead in this country, you certainly can get ahead. So this Omarosa woman, she did whatever she did. She's in the White House. And most recently, she's in the news because apparently she recorded herself when she got fired by General Kelly. General Kelly called her in to let her know she was being fired from the White House and she had to go. And I listened to the tape. First of all, I don't know if she's allowed to record in the White House and then put the tapes out. I'm thinking there has to be some kind of rule about recording any conversation in the White House and then putting it out on the media. You know, whether you like Trump or not, he is the president of the United States. And you can't just go around the White House recording conversations with government officials and then putting them out on the news. If it's a law enforcement need, then you get a warrant, and then you can record anybody you want. So let's be clear about that. I'm not saying they're above the law. I'm saying we have to be within the law. And I don't think it's smart for someone working there to record any government official for any reason and then put it out in the mass media. I don't think that does any of us any good. Now, that may or may not be illegal. I think we'll find that out soon enough. But she recorded General Kelly, and the way the media is portraying it and the way she's portrayed it, apparently, is that she was bullied and she felt that he was inappropriate in what he said to her. And I listened to the tape and I thought he was actually professional. I thought he was respectful. But you know what? She was getting fired. She wasn't getting hired. She was being fired. She was being let go. And at one point in the tape, she asks the general, does the president know about this? And he says, yeah, this is non-negotiable, which is a polite and professional way of saying, I understand you have this relationship with the president, and you think, if he knows about it, he wouldn't go along with it, and therefore you'd get to keep your job. That was the essence of what I got out of her comment. And when General Kelly said, no, this is non-negotiable, he was being professional. She was being let go. He was not going to sit and argue the point. Simple as that. When he says to her, I think if you look at this as a year of service to your nation, when you move on, there'll be no reputational problems or whatever. And she's taking that to be a threat. Oh my God, they're going to trash me if I don't go along with this. That's not the case at all. I think it's pretty clear that if you work for the President of the United States and you work in the White House and you want to go out and you're being fired for a reason. either you didn't do your job, you didn't do it well. And I think he said, I think the general said there were some integrity issues. So we can read into that whatever you want. There were some integrity issues, and they had to let her go. And what he was saying is, you know, if you make a big deal out of this, you start screaming and hollering, stomping your feet, those integrity issues are going to come out. And then you might have a problem with your next job because people find out you have integrity issues. So I didn't see it as a threat whatsoever. I thought he was actually trying to give her a little advice. You know, you're being let go. It's not negotiable. It's over. Here's the reason, some integrity issues. And if you just move on, you can move on with your life and you can say you served your country for a year. That'll look good on your resume. That'll be a wonderful thing. But if you're going to make problems over the whole thing, then it's going to come out what you did that was problematic here. And that's probably not going to help you in the future. Take it either way. You're being fired. That's what happens when you get fired. People tell you what they didn't like and you move along or you don't. So I found that to be interesting. Is there justice there? You know, that seems to be our theme today, the theme of justice. Is there justice? Well, if you're not doing the job, you get fired. It's interesting in our world today. People don't like that they can get fired. You know, you see people suing all the time. I got fired. You fired me improperly. Now, sure, I'm sure there's some times when the employer does something wrong and the employee brings it to people's attention, or maybe there's some kind of harassment going on or some other nonsense like that, and the employee has been wronged, and they bring it up, and they get fired. That's inappropriate, and in that case, the employer has to be held to account. But in general, you get hired to do a specific job, and if you don't do it well, the employer should be able to remove you from the job. You know, jobs are not rights. You don't have a right to a job just because you got it, you got through the interview process and were hired, and you have a right to that job forever. You have to perform. That's the whole basis of the system. And that's where I think, you know, that's one of the things as we look at this this crossroad we've changed, we've reached and gone down in our country. It's no longer about you doing your best and being held to account. It's about everybody's a victim. You know, I got this job and then I had some problems and they didn't train me properly or they didn't give me what I needed and I couldn't do it and that's why I failed and then they fired me and it's not fair. You go in, you do your best every day. You work hard and if you don't, you get fired. Simple as that. So I found that that interesting Omarosa on the news there. Then we had some weird stuff going on. What about the guy that stole the airplane? I had this guy out west. He stole an airplane. Apparently, he was a baggage claim guy, and he stole an airplane, and he's flying around in the airplane. So first of all, I would have to ask, how did he learn to fly the airplane? That he could, first of all, get onto an airplane. That I could see. He's the baggage guy. They all leave the airplane. The airplane's sitting there on the tarmac or whatever, and this guy manages to get in because he's a baggage handler. He has a right to be there, and he gets in. How does he start the plane? You know, they don't start with keys, I don't think. I don't think you turn a key to start an airplane unless it's a smaller airplane. But this was not a tiny airplane, I don't think, that he took. But he's flying it around. They said he's doing barrel rolls and whatnot. You have to know how to fly a plane to do that. That's not a simple thing to do. And then apparently he committed suicide crashing the plane. But he was talking to the tower. And I don't want to say he was in an upbeat mood because obviously the guy was suicidal, so that's terrible in itself. But he's on there saying, "Hey, I guess you know, stealing an airplane, that's going to get me prison for life, isn't it?" You know, it was almost humorous that he was making light of the situation. But then he crashed the airplane and killed himself. So that's pretty strange. I mean, who steals an airplane? There was a guy not too long ago tried to steal an airplane. I don't know how it worked out for him, but this guy actually got away with it. And he ended up crashing the airplane, which is terrible. We saw some protests this weekend in Washington. I guess these right-wing radical nuts had their Washington, D.C. Meeting or rally. I understand there was probably 40 of them that showed up. 40, that's it, 40. Of a nation that's supposedly filled with all of these right-wing nut racist people and only 40 of them show up, I think they're more of a nuisance than they're anything else. And I don't know anybody who agrees with their points of view or anything like that. I think they're nuts, and if they commit a crime, they should be locked up and done away with. But other than that, they have a right to, I guess, make their point known. So they got a permit, and they were going to do their big rally, and apparently 40 people showed up, and there was quite a few police officers there, and protesters were also there. There was some Antifa going on. That's another group. We're going to probably take a little closer look at the Antifa in the next couple of weeks so that we get a better picture of who these people are and what they're all about. If you look just on the surface and you look at what they're all about, they want to, you know, the media and everybody wants to call them right-wing or right-wing because they just want to throw anything right-wing they can at the Republican Party. But if you look at the Antifa, their actions, the things that they believe in, you see a lot of them run around carrying Soviet flags. They are much more left-wing than they are right-wing and conservative. There's nothing conservative about anything they believe in. They're radical. I believe they're leftists. They're violent. They show up with masks on so they can't be identified. And they often carry weapons. They commit lots of crimes. They attack police. They attack any other groups that they disagree with that are there. They smash public buildings. They cause damage. You know, who are these people? These young people that are out there hiding their faces, causing this damage. These kind of movements start slow. They start small and they start to grow. And we're seeing that this is growing. It's problematic. I think it's going to be a bigger problem as we get down the road. But I think here on Chasing Justice, we're going to take a closer look at the Antifa. If we can find out about the leadership, we can find out about exactly who they are. We're going to do a comparison of their belief system on the big circle of belief systems, you know, the ones that connect the far right to the far left at the apex, and they go all the way around. And we're going to see exactly who these people are, because I think they're a danger to all of us. And they are much more on the left, which, let's look at the violence that's going on out there. See, we're bouncing around here a lot in segment three. How many shootings were there this weekend in Chicago? How many people were killed in Chicago? Now, you can ask that question every weekend. And sometimes there are massive numbers of shootings. A couple weeks ago, there was 71 people shot in Chicago, and I think 8 or 9 people died. And everybody says, well, it mustn't be very serious shootings because only 8 or 9 people out of 71 died. Well, guess what? Here's the secret to that, to any kind of modern violence. While deaths are going down from violent attacks, the reasons they're going down is because medical technology has gotten better. Things that in the past would have killed you, you can be saved from now by surgical techniques. If you get shot, there were certain kinds of shootings. You just would not survive. You would die from that shooting or that beating or that stabbing or whatever. And now our medical procedures, techniques, drugs, and the skill of our surgeons has increased so much that they can save lots of more people that would have died in the past from violence. So we see Chicago. And now Chicago is an American city. And we see these massive shootings. There's shootings during the week, too. But the ones on the weekends are usually... Or the tally comes out on Sunday or Monday that there were, 71 shootings and 9 people murdered or 22 people murdered in a 48-hour period of time. This is an American city. What are they doing there to curtail that violence? Nobody seems to be addressing it. No one is having marches. I mean, there's innocent people that are kids on the street are killed, sitting in their houses, playing in the street, stray bullets killing people. But I don't see anybody marching on Chicago demanding justice for those kids. I want justice for the people in Chicago. Why would people have to live like that? We should do something. If the Mayor Emanuel, is not going to do anything to curtail the violence, then there should be some federal task force sent in there to go after whoever's committing these crimes. And they're saying a lot of it is gang-related, which is unfortunate because then I think people say, well, they're just killing each other. You know, what's the big deal? They're American citizens, and they're getting killed. And we can't just stand by because we don't like gangs. We have to put an end to that violence. That's not fair that they have to. The people that live there have to live under that kind of violence. So that would be the thing to do in the interest of justice. So, my dear listeners, we've come to the end of segment 3 here on Chasing Justice for this week. I'm glad we got to spend it together. I hope the fellas and ladies in the neighborhood are having a great vacation. But they better be back here pretty soon because I like having our conversation in the neighborhood. So until we meet again, remember, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. Have a great week, and we'll see you soon on Chasing Justice on the America Out Loud Radio Network.